From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, blues artist Otis Taylor brings his banjo to the studio. After 20 years away from the music business, he's back. His songs are searing, uncompromising, and intense. Also, we meet retired Lieutenant Colonel Bradley Biggs. He was the first officer selected for the U.S. Army's first all-black paratroop unit, the Triple Nickels. Trained for combat during World War II, instead, they battled forest fires started by Japanese balloon bombs in the Pacific Northwest. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers Beale Street, Memphis. In 1952, clubs on Beale Street helped launch the careers of Ike Turner, Little Junior Parker, B.B. King, and many others. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Mac Lee. Washington State's weather is cooling a little on the east side of the mountains, but not enough to help firefighters battling the more than 50,000 acres of blazes. From member station KPLU, Paige Hansen has more.
Highs in the 90s and low humidity make it a challenge to contain a wildfire in northeast Washington. One has burned a dozen homes. The state is in a level 5 alert, the most severe. It's mainly because there's not enough equipment or personnel to handle the fires, and winds could make the situation worse. Don Smith-Wade is with the National Interagency for Fires.
If all those storms do materialize, if the winds come up, then we could be in even a nastier situation than we find ourselves in now.
Fire gear is being stretched throughout the western part of the country at other wildfires. The Level 5 declaration clears the state fire managers to call in international help, hopefully from neighboring Canada. For NPR News, I'm Paige Hansen in Tacoma.
President Bush spoke by phone today with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon on the need to avoid escalating the tension in the region. Mr. Bush also offered condolences for two recent suicide bombings in Israel. The president did not speak with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Mr. Bush has repeatedly called for an end to the 10 months of bloodshed between Israelis and Palestinians, urging Arafat to discourage suicide bombings and Israel to use restraint. The FBI says more than 400 people have called a hotline set up for those who believe they received chemotherapy medicines from a Kansas City pharmacist. That pharmacist, Robert Courtney, is being held without bond, accused of diluting the drugs. Authorities say some of the drugs he dispensed contained only 1% of the prescribed dosage. James Ziegler, the new chief of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, made his first public appearance today at a district office where hundreds of immigrants seek service daily. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
Ziegler went to the office in Arlington, Virginia, to promise those waiting for service that he hoped to streamline the process and eliminate some of the backlogs that have plagued the INS. Ziegler also promised that the agency would treat everyone with dignity and respect.
I want you to feel like you have gotten good service, that you've gotten courtesy in the service that's been given to you, and that it's been given to you in a very timely fashion.
Several of the immigrants at the office said they had to wait on long lines and come back for repeat visits, often to get confusing advice. Ziegler is taking over at a time when Congress and the Bush administration are considering a major overhaul of the agency. The administration is also working on a plan that would allow some illegal immigrants to gain legal status. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
The Pentagon says the U.S. will provide medical support, helicopters, and unmanned reconnaissance aircraft when NATO sends troops to Macedonia. The NATO force will collect weapons from ethnic Albanian rebels. The advance party is expected to arrive in Macedonia before the weekend. The Dow rose 46 points today, the NASDAQ closed up 11, and the S&P was up 3. This is NPR News in Washington. Adventurer Steve Fawcett crossed the halfway point of his attempt to fly the world solo in a hot air balloon. From member station KWMU, Shula Newman reports that Fawcett's benchmark hasn't been without difficulties.
Turbulent winds over the Andes mountain range had Fawcett donning a parachute in case the winds caused his balloon to rupture. Keith Bennett, science director at Fawcett's Mission Control at Washington University in St. Louis, says crossing the Andes was the greatest anticipated challenge of the journey, but he says it should be more or less smooth sailing from here on.
Oh, nothing is ever smooth sailing. It's a slow flight, and that alone presents a lot of challenges, particularly keeping up with oxygen and water supplies. But basically, we don't anticipate any major problems at this point, but that's always hard to say.
Bennett says the ground crew's main concern now is how well Fawcett's equipment will hold up. Fawcett is currently sailing above northern Argentina. Bennett says if everything continues at the same pace, Fawcett should complete his flight in 10 to 14 days. For NPR News, I'm Shula Newman in St. Louis.
Reverend Al Sharpton gets out of jail tomorrow after serving 90 days for trespassing during a protest on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. Sharpton vows to leave the New York prison, in his words, better, not bitter. He says the country is turning to the right under President Bush, and he plans to run for president in 2004. Sharpton was arrested for protesting Navy bombing exercises on the Puerto Rican island. Dial Soap is facing a class action lawsuit filed on behalf of women working at a plant in Aurora, Illinois. The suit contends the women were subjected to sexually suggestive remarks and behavior. A company official calls the case weak and says Dial didn't break the law. Mission accomplished for astronauts attaching equipment to Space Station Alpha. The astronauts spent 6 hours on a spacewalk today. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, sitting in for Terry Gross. Otis Taylor's new CD opens with the sound of a train and a blues line that sets the tone for a recording critics describe as intense, unsettling, powerful, and uncompromising. Otis Taylor learned to play the ukulele, banjo, and guitar as a kid in Denver, Colorado, played in several blues and rock and roll bands, and then quit the music business in 1977. For 20 years, he worked as an antiques broker and appraiser before deciding to get back up on stage. White African is his third CD to be released in this second phase of Taylor's career. The opening track is My Soul's in Louisiana.
Well, my soul, Louisiana, but my body lies in Tennessee. I didn't kill no brakeman. I didn't kill no engineer. Well, a white man pointed his finger and they said what they always say. They didn't bother to hang me. They just shot me on the spot.
My Soul's in Louisiana from Otis Taylor's new CD, White African. Otis Taylor joins us from Boulder, Colorado. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Tell us about that song. Where is that story from?
Well, the idea was when I was a little kid, I hitchhiked in 64 to the Berkeley Folk Festival, but I had to go ask my father if I could hitchhike, and he told me that he used to ride the rails, you know. He used mm-hmm. to hobo, and he worked for the Pullman, so I was sort of surprised because he's kind of really surprised he did that. So I just thought about the Hills Boys boys and things that happened in the South, and whether it was white or black, about hobos and how they kind of got in a lot of trouble. When I was a little kid, I used to look for hobo camps at the Platte River. So I think I had this hobo thing in my head most of my life. So I just sort of write about a black hobo.
In the liner notes of your new CD, there are 12 pictures of black men, and underneath them the legend, wrong place, wrong time. What does that mean?
Well, I just collect things. I collect photographs of blacks in the West. I was at a gun show once, and looking for American Indian art, and I saw these photographs of these criminals, and or people that are arrested, or I wouldn't say people arrested, and so I brought the whole collection of all the blacks and a few women and other people of color, and I got them home, and I started reading the back of them, and it kept on saying, arrested, vagrancy released, arrested, vagrant, and so all those people were arrested and released, so they're just being hassled in the 30s, you mm-hmm. know, the late 20s and the 30s, and I thought it was sort of interesting, and so it's just sort of part of that kind of history.
There's one other picture, though, with the same legend, wrong place, wrong time.
Yeah, that was my uncle, Andrew Bell. He was he ran the streets, as we say, in the ghetto, you know, and he was, they were robbing a crap game, and he got shot. They said, give him money. He said no, and I guess he miscalculated something, and he was killed. Wrong place, wrong time, you know, that, part of that history, you know.
On this CD, we already heard some of the song about the guy who got shot for nothing. There's a song about suffering, another about a man trying not to cry when his mother's sick, another about a homeless man whose child is sick and dying, a song about lynching, and a song about hunger. There's a lot of bleak material there.
Is that bleak? I mean, you know, I remember going to see the movie Midnight Cowboy, and I got so depressed. Mm-hmm. I mean, why all of a sudden if I write a couple sad songs, or I went to see Songcatcher last night, nobody's, you know, I don't know. I think blues got a little party oriented, and so I'm kind of taking it back to maybe where it should be, or maybe people should think about that. I don't know. I don't think myself is so bleak. I mean, if you listen to Cloak and Dagger songs that the Appalachian people sing, those are pretty bleak songs too.
Hmm.
So I don't know why I'm getting the bleak rap, but that's the way it is.
I wonder if somebody in your record company or your producer said, you know, hey, you mind if we want to lighten this up a little bit, just a little
bit?
Oh,
he did. My producer, he positively did. He actually positively said, Otis, all these songs are depressing. I go, well, let's do the first three depressing songs first and just crucify them. Let's just go for it. I mean, this is what I do. This is what I'm doing. And I'm happy with this. So let's not try to cover it up, you know? And it worked. It was very successful, luckily. But he did argue with me.
Producers generally win those arguments.
He's my best friend. That helps. He's the one who rediscovered me. Kenny Passarelli. He's my producer, and we're good friends, and that's why we work together as a team.
You grew up in Denver, and that is not a place that immediately leaps to mind as you know, the birthplace of the blues.
No. I was born in Chicago, and my parents are from... My father's from Memphis. My mother's from Lake Providence. I'm like what you call first-generation Southern, like an immigrant, you know, when people migrated to Chicago, you know, some part of that great migration, sort of.
How old were you when you first got interested in music?
I was 14 and a half. Well, I always liked music, but I got my banjo, my first banjo, when I was 14 and a half at the Denver Folklore Center.
Now, you live nearby that?
Yeah, about five blocks away, yeah.
And you used to go over there and hang out?
Hang out. I lived there after school, on the weekends, you know. A lot of kids lived there. It was a beautiful place. It was a beautiful time in history during that sort of folk, early folk time, you know, before psychedelic, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And you would, ask people to teach you stuff?
Yeah, I learned how to play for free. I just bummed lessons in between the teacher's classes. And that was a pain in the you-know-what, but they did it, and look at what happened. So it was beautiful, you know, and I really appreciate it.
What kind of music were you playing then?
I was playing old-timey banjo, Appalachian-style banjo. And you're talking about the story where I went to a party and my banjo teacher, Mike Kropp, he took me to a party where the Dillards were at. And I played banjo. They go, hey, you're really good. You can really play. You should go down. This is like 1964, maybe 65. They said, you should go down south to those banjo contests. And I said, what did you say? And I thought, thinking, down south, they're lynching people, killing black people. Then I said, I don't want to play the banjo. Not much. I said, I think I want to back off and play harmonica more or something. I got freaked out. And the sad part about it, you know, like until 9 years ago, I didn't even know the banjo came from Africa, which is really sad because I was like freaking out over something that was part of my heritage, which was really a heartbreak when you think about it.
It's almost, given the stereotypes, it's almost daring for a black man to play the banjo.
Well, yeah, but isn't that sad, you know? it's a black instrument, and you know, Taj Mahal still plays. Alvin Young Blackheart's an incredible banjo player. Mm-hmm. John Jackson plays a banjo, and the guitar tunings are banjo tunings. You know, your Delta guitar, they're open tunings. That's what the banjo is. You know, and so it's the whole thing. The blues to me came from the banjo styles.
You once said a fascinating thing about the styles that you learned as you grew up and as you progressed as a musician. You've been kind enough to bring your banjo into the studio with you there. And I was wondering if you could show us and describe for us what you're doing, the different styles that you learned and as you progressed to a style that's all your own.
Okay, sure. We'll try to. I've never done a workshop on this exactly.
Okay.
Sort of, yeah, but I'll try to. Like, say if you're frailing. That's going to be a very traditional. That's your sort of frailing style.
And that's the style that you would have first learned for the Appalachian style.
Yeah. Then you're picking sort of. Picking.
Mm-hmm.
And then my style is the same style I play guitar. It was the same style when I was playing playing banjo, when I play guitar, people say, please play a guitar like a banjo, even when I was playing guitar.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't thinking about it. I just... That's my style. But I play the same style on guitar, too. See?
On your new CD, White African, you do one song with the acoustic banjo, Mama Don't You Do It. Could you play it for us?
Yeah. Mama don't you do it, dude. Mama don't you die. Mama don't you do it. Don't make me cry. My mama is gone, don't die. I don't want to cry.
Otis Taylor, his new CD is White African. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Otis Taylor. His new CD is White African. And I have to ask you, you come up with some of the great record titles I've ever heard. It's not only Blue-Eyed Monster was your first comeback album, and then When Negroes Walk the Earth, and now White African. There's a lot of thought go into those?
No, and yeah. I just sort of, they come to me, you know? I had this blue eye thing going, but I wanted to stay away from Frank Sinatra. So I had to get something with the blue eyes and stay away from, you know? So like, no, seriously, I'm not joking now. I'm serious. And I wanted to, but you can laugh if you want, but I just want you to know, I was thinking, hey, I got the blue eye, I got blue. See, I have blue eyes, by the way. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah. So I was trying to, but stay away from that sort of Frank Sinatra thing. So I came up with the monster thing, you know? And then When Negroes Walk the Earth, the original Negroes Walk the Earth was going to be High Desert Negro.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay, but it's not kicking it. It's not kicking it. And I just sort of play with it, and bam, then it came through. Then White African was just sort of started off as White African. But a lot of people told me after When Negroes Walk the Earth, they said I couldn't come up with a title as good as that. So I decided I'd take the challenge. I wasn't going to let them say that to me. And I'm happy with White African.
When you grew up in Denver, Colorado, did you listen to a lot of blues records? Were you a student?
No. My father was a big, big jazz friend. He was a bebopper. He hung out with the jazz people. He worked for the railroad, so he was their best friends, you know what I mean? And he'd go across the country as a Pullman. He'd be in San Francisco one day, and 3 days later be in New York. And he just would go all the festivals and hang out at the jazz clubs. And when I was home, a kid, people they have a lot of parties, and I couldn't sleep at night because they're making so much noise. And so they were like, I'm like second generation hip, you know what I mean? But one day my mother got this Etta James thing, Can't Judge a Book by the Cover. All I Want to Do is Make Love to You, whatever it was, that big hit.
Mm-hmm.
And they played it for about 8 hours, and I really got into that, you know. I think that's when it was starting. And I remember when the Rolling Stones first did it, I didn't like their version. So I was already getting ideas about what I liked and didn't like when I was a kid about commercialism, you know.
Well, was there a moment, though, when you decided to become a musician?
Yeah, when I found out they like girls, I decided, yeah, this works. I could do this. I'm serious. You think I'm joking.
I think you're dead serious. Yeah. Now, this was the late 60s. What kind of bands were you playing in then?
The first band I had was called the Butterscotch Fire Department.
Yes, it was the late 60s, wasn't it?
Yeah, positively. Our first gig, which I thought was interesting, was the Mr. Colorado Bodybuilding Pageant. That was like a trip, man. That was. I wish I could make a movie about that. That was a trip, you know.
So you're playing psychedelic rock and roll at that point?
No, still traditional kind of rock and roll blues. Still not so psychedelic. I never got too psychedelic, ever, in a sense, you know. I was That's why Kenny came back and got me, because he said I was the least commercial, the more sort of into the roots of it all, you know. I still like Hendrix songs, and I used to like Arthur Lee Love. I used to like their stuff a little bit, but I was pretty into Hollingwood from Muddy Waters and things like that, you know. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Now, in 1969, it looked for a little while like you might become a star.
Yeah, but it got messed up. I was with Blue Horizon Records, which did like a, you know, the original Fleetwood Mac and Johnny Signs. But I was living in London, and I signed something when I was 19. Actually, my father had to sign it.
A record contract.
Yeah, and they gave me no money, no nothing. And I said, well, I need some money to live. I go, well, you don't do that. I said, okay, bye. You know, I just left. I didn't care, you know. I'm that kind of person. I guess I'm just not kind of live life on my own terms. That's why I could quit music for 20 years, you know.
Well, tell me about that. Why and when did you decide to leave the music business?
Well, at that time I was playing bass in a band called Zephyr, and they were good friends, and we kind of had a fight, and it got close to getting physical. And I said, if I got to get physical, I don't want to do this anymore. And about 2 months later, the couple that I played with got divorced, so they're just going through some hard times, you know. Now we're, she passed away. I'm still good friends with David, but I just said, I don't need this. I didn't need it. I don't think one should need anything, you know, when it comes to art. I don't want to be an art victim, so I just walked away, you know. But I play music at home. See, people think if you don't play in public, they think you stop music completely. You know what I mean? They kind of get that confused.
One of the things that jumps out, though, in your biography is the blues man who was an antiques broker.
Yeah, that's okay. Whatever.
No, it just seems, you know, just a little odd juxtaposition there.
Oh, I know a lot of guys who are antique brokers who played music, and you'd be surprised. Because antique brokers are like high-class collectors. They collect, and then when the collecting gets too expensive, they start buying and selling. That's how it kind of, they become antique dealers. They just want to afford their habit. You know what I mean?
Is that how it started with you?
I think for a lot of dealers, you know, like to collect.
What were you collecting?
American Indian art, you know, ethnographic art.
And at what point did it get too expensive?
It got too expensive when I was able to sell it and buy a house in Boulder.
Mm-hmm.
Which I've lived off for the rest of my life, you know. So that's when it got too expensive, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It was time to sell.
Now, when did you decide, as I understand, it was no great, you know, instant light bulb epiphany going off over your head to get back into the music business. You'd been playing all along.
Yeah, well, it was an accident. I had a friend named Buck Buchanan, had these stores called Buccaneer Stores, women's stores, and I was involved with bicycle racing in the 80s for about 5 years. I had two kids on the national team, third best team in the nation. And he was our main sponsor. I was a co-sponsor. And, you know, then he had these businesses that kind of went belly up, and he went Chapter 13. So he opened up a coffee house. And I guess, you know, Judy Rodgers played there and Judy Collins. And it was, you know, he sort of reopened this coffee house. And he asked me about getting equipment for PA because he knew I knew about music. And I said, Buck, I'll call some friends and we'll come down and play for you. And I ain't played in 20 years, but I will play music for you, Buck. And we did, and it sounded so good, we just kept on going. It was a fluke. It was just a fluke. I hadn't really thought about it.
But I assume that, you know, the headlines were not, he's back. I mean, this was not the comeback
No.
of Michael Jordan or something like that. I mean, this was No. a difficult trail that you were starting out on.
Yeah, yeah. I was, I had a friend who has a record shop, Twist and Shout in Denver, and he always said I was obscure when I was young, and then I was obscure again. I'll probably be obscure again. I'm always going to be obscure because I'm not that commercial, you know. I don't think so. Maybe I will be. Maybe people will catch up with me or something, but I'm not really that commercial. But if you want to buy my record, please do that. Let me stop you. But you know what I'm saying, don't you?
Sure.
You know? Yeah.
You've got your banjo there. Is there something you'd like to play for us?
What do you want to hear? One of my songs? Or you want to hear? What do you want to hear?
Why don't we hear one of your songs?
One of my songs? Okay, give me a sec. Okay, I'm going to write a song for you guys, okay? This is my dedication to you guys taking the time to do this for me. So you have to give me like a word or two words and I'll write a song about it. I can do this, man. Trust me.
Window.
Window. Oh, that's so easy. Maybe. Don't close. up on me. Sitting by my window, thinking about how things used to be. I think I'm going down to Pennsylvania. My goal. Mexico. I think I'm gonna go down to Pennsylvania, roll on to Mexico, to Mexico.
Window Blues by Otis Taylor. We'll continue with Otis Taylor in the second half of the show. I'm Neil Conan, and this is Fresh Air.
Round and round. Round and round. Driving me crazy. Go round and round. Driving me crazy. Round and round. Go round and round. Driving me crazy. Yeah. Round and round. Go round. Driving me crazy. Go round and round, go round and round, round and round, driving me crazy, round and round.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Saab, maker of the 9.5 sedan and the 9.5 wagon. Independent quality and safety evaluations of Saab 9.5's performance available at saabusa.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the Triple Nickels. We talk with retired Lieutenant Colonel Bradley Biggs, who was part of America's first all-black paratroop unit. During the Second World War, they fought the forest fires triggered by Japanese balloon bombs. Also, Ed Ward remembers Beale Street, Memphis, circa 1952, and more with blues artist Otis Taylor. This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's hear more of our conversation with blues artist Otis Taylor, who's back after 20 years away from the music business. His new CD is White African, and he performs at blues and folk festivals around the country. You also teach blues.
Yeah, I do. I do. I don't call it teaching blues. I just try to turn kids on to the conceptual thought of blues. I do a thing that my wife, Carol Taylor, thought of. It's called Writing the Blues Program, and we take it into schools and colleges and universities, and have a thing, I get the blues win, then they fill out what makes them sad. So then they can think how the slaves felt when they're working in the fields trying to get through the day. So I try to get them to teach the emotion of the blues to people, not so much the technical part, you know, just the emotion.
What kind of stuff do the students come up with?
Oh, I was in Ottawa. We did a school, and there was a lot of refugees from Somalia and Kosovo. And every other kid said, well, my uncle died, well, my cousin died. And then this one kid comes up and goes, well, when I couldn't have my Matendo. And I'm thinking, whoa, this got light all of a sudden. And then it hit me that his parents were divorced, and he can only have one Matendo at one house when he goes to visit. It came to me what he was really trying to say, and that was pretty deep. But they say, you know, their parents go to jail or just all kinds of bizarre things sometimes, you know. Because they're kids. But then I have adults say bizarre things, too. I've had adults literally cry when they're doing their sessions with me, too. So it's pretty deep. It's pretty intense.
You have kids of your own.
Yeah. My oldest daughter sings on the album, Cassie Taylor.
I wondered whether part of your decision about making a comeback in music, whether that involved your kids and your decision that you wanted to speak to them to some degree.
Well, I think what I wanted to do is leave some kind of legacy about who I was a long time ago. Because when I married my wife, she had no idea. She knew I had instruments around the house I played, but she didn't think I was. I was involved with bicycle racing. She said she would marry me if I quit bicycle racing, so I did quit it. And then I snuck up on her 10 years later and started this music thing. So she wasn't prepared for it. And I just wanted to kind of leave a legacy of who I was to my kids, maybe more so. I really sincerely felt that. And that's what Kenny told me. And Harry Tufte of the Folklore Center said, if I don't do it now, I wouldn't get it done. And so I went for it.
There is one song on your CD, White African, that is particularly personal, the St. Martha Blues. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it all started, my mother's very closed off about the South, and they don't talk about it much. My father talked about it a little bit. But they really didn't talk about it much, and I think it's like Vietnam syndrome. You go through certain things, and you just don't really want to talk about it. And I think if you track enough black families, that 50% of them have relatives that were lynched, you know, during those time periods. And people don't talk about it much. And I was trying to find out about the Native American Indian blood we had in our family, and so I had to call my mom up and start talking about this. And I was a little confused because we have a step grandfather and a real grandfather, and it sort of got very confusing, and so the stories start coming out about, well, you know, your great-grandfather got, you know, lynched, and so I kind of, that all came together. But the true story about the lynching was, my grandfather, he was ordained by Nat King Cole's father, and when he got his church, he named her the Greatest St. Martha, and that's why he wrote the song, because he loved his mother so much, he didn't name it after a religious figure. He named it after his mother, and I thought that was really interesting.
Otis Taylor, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
We'll end by listening to St. Martha Blues from Otis Taylor's new CD, White African.
My great-grandfather, back in Lake Providence, Louisiana, he was lynched. Not only was he lynched, they took his body and they tore it apart and they went to his wife, Martha Jones, and told her where she could find her husband. Poor, poor Martha. She got to go downtown. Oh, she got to go. She got to go and find a husband.
They came to the door. They took him away. They hung him from the highest tree. They tore his poor body apart.
Otis Taylor, his new CD is White African. Coming up, America's first black paratroopers, the Triple Nickels. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Neil Conan. During the Second World War, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt visited the Army Parachute School at Fort Benning, Georgia, and asked, "Where are your Negro paratroopers?" The still segregated U.S. Army had already formed all-black infantry and tank units, but African-American soldiers were largely relegated to non-combat duties, and the jump boots, wings, and bloused trousers of the elite parachute regiments were off limits. Shortly after the president's pointed question, the Army started a black airborne test platoon that expanded into the 555th Parachute Infantry Battalion, the Triple Nickels. As the war was ending in Europe, the unit's mission was changed. The Triple Nickels became the Army's first smoke jumpers and battled Japanese balloon bombs in the forests of California and the Pacific Northwest. Bradley Biggs was the first officer selected for that unit. He later wrote a history called The Triple Nickels. He joins us now from Chicago. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
In the segregated army that you joined before the Second World War, what were your options?
Very few. I was with the 372nd Infantry, and we were stationed in Brooklyn, guarding bridges, of all things. And I asked myself one day, is this where I'm going to spend my military career? Because I always wanted to be an Army officer. And I said, no way. So I went off to Officer Candidate School and got a commissioned second lieutenant of infantry. And from then on, I said, well, let's get where the action is. But like most of the men who came to join us, they want to be recognized as soldiers, which is their citizenship and democratic right and privilege.
And soldiers who did more than drive trucks or
who did more than drive trucks or pass ammunition. They wanted to do something differently. They didn't want to go into an organization that handled ammunition or rations or swept the streets or grave registration. They wanted to be where the action was. And that's what our spirit and morale was based upon, men who wanted the action. And we got them.
Since you guys were the first blacks in parachute school, all of the men who trained you, by definition, had to be white. Did they make it hard on you?
A few did. One of the questions that struck us was, how are we going to deal with the white instructors who are questioning who is going to train the black paratroopers? Now, can you imagine being assigned to a duty, risky as parachuting is, working under an instructor who doubted that you could really do the job? So we said, well, we're going to ignore that and go on and do it anyway. And we said, under no circumstance are any of us going to quit. We're going to jump out that 34-foot tower if we have to do it without a harness. And Cal Cunha said, well, jump out that airplane without a parachute if need be. Of course, he didn't mean that, but that was the spirit and the attitude that we had.
Now, you ended up with more than 360 jumps, but I bet you remember that first one particularly well.
Yes.
What was it like?
There's some apprehension. You are graded on the manner in which you exit from the aircraft. You are graded also on the way you landed from the end of your parachute jump experience. You're also graded on a manner in which you control your chute in the air. So there's some apprehension that you're going to do the right things you've been trained because you're under scrutiny from the instructor in the airplane as well as an instructor on the ground. You want to make sure you did the right thing and did it right.
Now, when you jumped out that door the first time, did you look down?
Oh, absolutely. I was looking down, looking for the ground. And there was no fear, no consternation. But there's a very difficult, apprehension that you experience when you jump out of an airplane. But after a while, you get used to it, and it becomes a matter of fact.
At the time, the bases at which you were training in Georgia, North Carolina, the conditions outside the base had to be difficult.
They were very difficult indeed, but we made a point to avoid the difficult spots. You don't look at a stone wall and run into it just because it's there. You stay out of the trouble areas because you know they're going to be difficulties if you go into them. So we always told our men, and we practiced it ourselves, that if you're going to go to town, go where you want to go, comport yourself so that the police don't have to keep an eye on you, don't allow yourself to get involved in fights or scrapes, and above all, don't get into encounters with the local police, because they'll put you in jail and fine you in a minute.
One thing that made the Triple Nickels different from the other all-black units that were formed at about the same time was the fact that this unit was officered completely by blacks. That was extremely controversial because at that moment, you're putting black men, African-Americans, in the chain of command.
That was our great pride, that we're a black from commanding officer down to the lowest private. We did not have any white officers come in and tell us what to do. We knew what we had to do, we were prepared for it, we trained for it, and we performed the highest standards possible. We did not appreciate the fact that any white officers would come down and give us some ideas. We already had our own policies in place. And we knew that from our training, we had done exceedingly well, and having men follow in our footsteps, then they would also do well.
The official explanation, the Army's official explanation for not sending the Triple Nickels to fight in Europe was that the battalion was not up to full strength and they wanted to send a complete battalion. It didn't have the full complement of men. Do you buy that?
No, we did not buy that at all. We were as trained and as competent as any other white organization, airborne or otherwise. What we did face was a shortage of personnel, but we could have picked up more personnel overseas. Recall after the Battle of the Bulge, a request was made for Negro soldiers to volunteer to serve in white units, and they were what is called the 5th Platoon. We had some of those 5th Platoon members join us in the 555 after World War II. They were gladly to volunteer to serve with us if we were going overseas during World War II. So that argument just doesn't hold any water.
Why do you think you weren't sent?
We were not sent overseas because a new mission came up to send us out west to combat the Japanese balloon invasion, which many people thought was serious enough to keep us out of the fighting in Europe. And furthermore, the fight in Europe was taking a different turn, where the need for paratroopers was not as great as it had been.
So in April 1945, you're all put on a train to go to the West Coast. You arrive in Pendleton, Oregon, and you find out that you have a completely new mission.
We appreciated the fact that we were selected for a new mission. We did not know what it was until we got out to Oregon. By the way, the population of Oregon was only 2% black. And we faced a lot of discrimination when we arrived on the scene.
It was no better than Georgia?
No better than Georgia. We could not go into a hotel. The restaurants in town would not serve us. There's only one place in town where we could get a pool table to play pool on or to get a Coca-Cola.
Tell us about the balloon bombs. These were released by the Japanese from Japan, obviously, and then floated across the Pacific?
Yes, they were released from a base in Honshu, Japan, and they used the stratosphere to move them across the Pacific Ocean. They used the same air currents that our strategic bombers were later to use when they were practicing mission runs to bomb Russia. They would travel across the Pacific Ocean at a speed of about 100 to 185 miles per hour. And they had a very ingenious device on them that when they reached a certain altitude, the balloon would cool and lower itself to a warmer altitude where it would inflate and rise again. Now, before it would rise, a device would drop a sandbag, making the balloon lighter than it was when it left the island of Honshu. It would take about 3 days for one to get across the Pacific Ocean. And by the time it reached the West Coast, all the sandbags had been dropped. The balloon was weighted with a bomb or incendiary bombs so that the weight of it would land into a wooded area explode or detonate.
I'm speaking with Bradley Biggs. He's the author of The Triple Nickels, America's first all-black paratroop unit, a unit in which he served during the Second World War and afterwards. Eventually, the Japanese stopped sending balloon bombs, and the Triple Nickels were called back to the East Coast and absorbed into the 82nd Airborne Division, and you got to march down Fifth Avenue in New York City in the great parade celebrating the end of the Second World War.
Yes, that was General Gavin's doing. General Gavin was colorblind. He had always been a proponent of integration, having served with black troops, and he knew what they could do. So he took the battalion under his wing, had us put on the 82nd Airborne Division patch, and marched down Fifth Avenue with the 82nd Airborne Division. That was a wonderful, wonderful gesture. And that really gave us an awful lot of good morale, things to talk about.
There was also an incident that happened to the Triple Nickels in addition to the parade in Manhattan in New York City. There were other, of course, celebrations, but there were also a lot of training exercises that you guys went on, and one of them happened at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida, and I was wondering if you could tell us that story.
That was not really the 555th Parachute Infantry Battalion as an organization. It was the personnel from the 555. And we had already been integrated into the 82nd Airborne Division. Now, we went into Eglin Air Force Base Operation as a major ground force unit. And one day, while we were in the preparatory to going to the ground operation after we made our jump, a flight of B-29 bombers was off course. And they dropped their bombs on the tank company and our battalion, which was in the staging area.
Live bombs?
Live 29 bombs from 10,000 feet. We lost a half a dozen men, about a dozen or so were wounded. The tankers lost five or six men and several people wounded.
Accidents happen in training exercises as well as in warfare. Friendly fire does happen. But this incident, you write in your book, was never really investigated.
The investigation was done by the Army, was swept under the rug. A small article appeared in the newspaper somewhere in Florida, and that was it. When I talked with the battalion commander, the squadron commander, he said, well, my navigator said he was on course and on target, and he let his bombs go at the right point. And that just shut up the whole case.
So nothing ever happened? Nobody
nothing
was ever...
Nothing ever happened?
No one
has
ever held
responsible? Nobody was ever punished?
Did you ever find out why not?
No, we never did. It was closed case, and we had to go let it go at that. What more could we do?
Do you think, I just have to ask the question, do you think it would have been swept under the rug if those bombs had fallen on white troops?
It would not have been swept under the rug. They would have been hit in the newspapers because the press was never favorable where black troops were concerned in any war. But if they were white soldiers, the white press would have been out there looking at what's going on, and they would have carried on that investigation until they got something done.
What would you say is the legacy of the Triple Nickels?
We persevered in the face of being programmed for defeat. We want the plebes at West Point, the midshipmen at Annapolis, the cadets at the Air Force Academy to read what we have done and how we did it. And if they can do that and understand the perseverance that went through our ranks and how we felt in terms of pride and also not only just pride but loyalty to our country, that they'd be more prone to feel the same way about their country. The whole nation needs to hear our story of how we persevered in the face of opposition from everyone who did not believe that the Negro paratrooper could survive. And we did survive with great firsts and great accomplishments, more than any other Army unit.
Thank you very much for coming in and speaking with us.
It's my responsibility and obligation to do so.
Bradley Biggs' book about America's first all-black paratroop unit is still in print. It's called The Triple Nickels. Coming up, Ed Ward remembers one of rock and roll's mother roads, Beale Street. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. The history of rock and roll is filled with places where things came together in just the right way and where careers were launched. Beale Street in Memphis was one of those legendary musical breeding grounds. It began in the 1920s and continued for decades. Rock historian Ed Ward offers us a snapshot of Beale Street in 1952 from recordings made by Ike Turner.
There are a lot of places I'd like to visit with a time machine, but there are few of them as appealing as Beale Street in Memphis in 1952. The place was jumping with a hot blues scene which was just being discovered by the outside world, and except for a kid named Elvis Presley and his friends, no white people were visiting there. Another young guy who was on the scene was a piano player from Mississippi who seemed to know all the rising stars. His name was Ike Turner. Turner knew that records were the way to go if anybody on Beale was going to get rich, and he'd take his discoveries to the Memphis Recording Service, owned by Sam Phillips, a white blues fan who'd learned radio engineering in the war, and Mr. Phillips would send the masters off to the Behari brothers in Los Angeles, who owned a number of labels, including Modern, Flair, Kent, and RPM. And boy, did the Beharis like those packages from Memphis. Turner had an ear for talent, as we'll hear with these recordings he made in 1952. He started with the most popular guy on the scene, Roscoe Gordon. I want to tell you about that gal of mine. I want to tell you about that gal of mine. She want to stay every day and boogie woogie all the time. She's a hot. Gordon sang the blues and sometimes had a dancing rooster on his piano, and although his records sound pretty primitive today, they sold. He was huge throughout the South and loved to gamble, so one night in Arkansas, in a hot dice game he didn't want to get out of immediately, he put his driver on stage and told him to do a few numbers. Well, I'm just a poor boy, drifting town to town. Bobby Bland had one of those voices, and even on these, his earliest recordings, you can tell he was destined for greatness. He's still at it, in fact. And just as soon as Bobby became a star, he hired himself a valet from that Beale Street pool of talent. You angel from heaven up above. Hey, you angel from heaven up above. Yes, oh, what a dream, girl. Little Junior Parker would go on to make much better records than You're My Angel, including Mystery Train and Driving Wheel, before he died during a botched surgery at the age of 40. Then there was the kid from Mississippi who just shown up in town one day and won so many of the weekly talent shows that they gave him a radio show to keep him from competing anymore. He, unlike the rest, had already recorded in Nashville, but it was in Memphis that B.B. King would make his name. B.B. Boogie, darling, the B.B. Boogie, baby, do the B.B. Boogie been touch you all night long? Well, I looked at the clock, the clock's at 4, my baby jumped up, she said, be my score, do the B.B. Boogie, baby. B.B. had a piano player who was pretty good named Johnny Ace. Johnny only cut one side for Ike Turner, but it showed that he had a pretty good voice, too. When those midnight hours journey, I was in my bed alone. When those midnight hours journey, Junior Parker, B.B. King, Johnny Ace, and Ike Turner all played on each other's records, which gave birth to the name the Beale Streeters for what was really just an impromptu band. They recorded behind gospel singers and blues singers, but probably never played on stage as a group. And they also had a drummer who spent his whole life behind the scenes, a man named Earl Forrest.
Oh, he mama, she's all right with me. Got a whole heap of mama, and she's all right with me. How she eat my pain, how she soothes my misery.
This was all too good to last forever, but it lasted until at least 1954, when Johnny Ace either did or didn't commit suicide, depending on who you talk to. B.B. King, Bobby Bland, Ike Turner, and Roscoe Gordon are performing to this day, and Earl Forrest still writes songs for blues acts. The Beale Streeters are still around, but boy, I would have liked to have seen them then.
Ed Ward is a writer living in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, Lauren Krenzel, and Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs our show. The engineer is Bob Purdick. For Terry Gross, I'm Neil Conan.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Universal Pictures, presenting Captain Corelli's Mandolin, from the director of Shakespeare in Love, starring Nicolas Cage and Penelope Cruz, opens August 17th nationwide. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Niagara Falls All Over Again, a novel by Elizabeth McCracken, the author of The Giant's House. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Steve Buscemi. He stars in the new film Ghost World as a blues record collector who can't get a date. And novelist Michael Chabon, his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, is out in paperback. I'm Neil Conan. Join us for the next Fresh Air.